and welcome to a brand new episode of Invasion of the Podcasters. Each week we go through a range of streaming services, what's on TV, Amazon, Netflix, Shudder, Disney+.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, but I'm just trying to elaborate on what's out
there. Yeah, yeah. You name it, we probably have it.
Yeah, and well, that's a big shock announcement as well, to let you guys know that I've now signed up to Amazon Prime as well.
You've seen the light.
Well,
goodness.
No, the good lady, her hobbyist, her indoors, accidentally signed up for it. She says accidentally, but she was buying something and she didn't click the opt-out option, so she went, I've been meaning to do it for years, so we'll just stick with it. So
happens to the best.
Accidentally on purpose, I think, is what you'd call that.
Exactly. So we've got pretty much, well, we've definitely got all of the major streaming services all covered. I think, Simon, you cover slightly more of the obscure. What? I cover TV, yes.
We don't have Apple TV.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, that's true.
Sorry.
I just said Apple. We'll see. I mean, I said I wouldn't sign up for Disney+. I said I wouldn't sign up for Amazon Prime, and look where that's gone. So,
yeah, never say never to anything on this one.
Yeah, but we're all talking all friends here, but we might have new listeners. So let's do a little roundup of introducing ourselves. So with me, we've got Simon.
Hello, guys. Simon here. As Graham alluded to there, I look at some of the more obscure streaming services, such as formerly Shudder, but nowadays it's Mubi, it's BFI Player, it is Arrow Player, and in a recurring special guest appearance on the podcast, Now TV. So that's what you can expect from me.
Very good. And as well, we have Scott.
Scott here. Hi, guys. I look after Amazon and Netflix, and also Disney Plus now. The more mainstream streaming services.
And then finally, you've got myself, Graham. I look after what's on TV, your free-to-air streaming services, like All4, BBC iPlayer. But I've now also adopted, been on Netflix for a while, but now Disney Plus and Amazon Prime, so I can get in with some of that action as well.
Well, so, I think we've all bitten off more than we can chew now, which is nice to see.
Are there enough hours in the day for everything? I don't think so.
Definitely not.
Each week we go through and select each episode, because we're running about every fortnight at the moment. But each episode we run through the pick of what we are aiming to watch, what we want to pick out for you listeners out there, things that you might have missed, and giving our opinions and also asking for your feedback and your opinions as well. But we like to start off each episode by going through a couple of items of news. And this week Scott picked out an article about the Golden Globes. So I'll hand over to you, Scott. And what was it you'd want to raise our awareness of?
Yeah, so obviously it's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association who vote on the Golden Globes and ultimately hand out those awards. And there's often been commentary about the lack of inclusion of black members within that organisation. The only African members are from North Africa, so Egypt, for example. And there's no members from the Caribbean, say, from the press in that area. And ultimately, there's no black members of the Hollywood Press Association. So it's often been pointed out. But now there appears to be some backlash from some very influential individuals and organisations. For example, NBC, who have been screening the Golden Globe ceremony, have announced they're not going to screen the 2022 ceremony. And Tom Cruise, obviously one of the biggest names in acting, has returned his 3 Golden Globes in protest. So just despite a lot of talk about it in the last few years, certainly I've seen stuff about this fairly recently, but only now there seems to be a bona fide backlash from people in the industry. So this might be a turning point and a crossroads that the Golden Globes must face. And the Press Association must face, and hopefully this will now bring about a proper change in the industry. Because quite clearly, if there's no sort of sub-Saharan African members, people not from North Africa, then that is a massive problem, I think. Because I think it's absolutely essential that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association has representation from every country, not necessarily every country, but certainly every region. So the Caribbean, Southern Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, etc. All those different areas need to have representation, and it's good that this is being highlighted. What do you guys think? Have you been aware of these sorts of problems, and how do you feel about what's been announced?
Well, I mean, it's always been bubbling on in the background, hasn't it? But now the chickens have come home to roost, as it were. Sorry, that sounded very doom-laden and quite sinister, but it's a good thing, really. You know, people are finally taking a stand for this sort of thing, and, you know, the thing is, I hadn't really known about it until you told me the other day, and I was like, oh, well, you know what, that's quite nice to see that that is all happening, so... What about you, Grim?
Yeah, well, the only good thing to have come out of the Golden Globes in years is the fact that Ricky Gervais has often done the presenting role of it. I think that's only one good aspect of it, to be honest. The rest of it, the voting of it, the just the industry backpatting and schmoozing around of what goes on just to fuel the industry is... I don't know why the awards are given out, basically. It's just an excuse for self-promotion, really. Which, to be honest, though, I know that now stars are coming out and putting their opinions forward, but they've been accepting awards for years and they've known about this, so why suddenly now? So you just hope as if, like, yeah, but fair enough, if they're all now coming out with it, let's hope it does make some change. But at the same time, it's like they're guilty of being toeing the line for decades. So it's one of those things where it's easy, once it's there, it's in the limelight, that people come out of the woodwork and say what their piece, but... Well, let's just hope it does have some impact and some change. There is, strangely as well, we've got two articles of news. We normally focus on just one. You've picked another item out, Simon. So what was it about this one that you want to cover?
Yeah, so this is kind of like our B story for the week. but I just found it too weird not to talk about. It's the fact that people are beginning to use deepfake technology to make dubbing more seamless on old movies. So I think they're using Flawless technology with something called TrueSync to basically make it look like, say, if an actor was speaking in English but the dub track was Chinese, then they would look like they were speaking Chinese. And I was thinking, if you ended up doing that with films, that, you know, the dubbing is so integral to what you see on screen. So, you know, you think about something like an Italian horror movie from the 1960s where everything's deliberately unsynced and, you know, just that's part of the trashy appeal of it. I think we're going to enter a new uncanny valley of weird dubbing. And I don't like dubbing anyway. Come on, you've got to go for, like, the original track, unless it is, like, literally hard-coded into the film, like a lot of the old Italian releases are. But, yeah, what a strange time to be alive. Look at a few of the clips. I think they've done something with Jack Nicholson and a few Good Men, which just makes him look like he's, you know, that will just change the way that scene looks forever, because that close-up on his face is so indelible when he's like, you can't handle the truth! And, yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to point that out to people because I thought it was kind of funny.
I mean, some of the deep fake videos that I've seen online, the one with Tom Holland and Robert Downey Jr. replacing Doc and Marty from Back to the Future...
What?
The quality of that visually is amazing. But you just think, where's it going to go next? And they've obviously taken it to, oh, let's just redub things and change people's mouths so it doesn't look as weird. But yeah, it's a bit too far. I mean, just because the technology can do it, should it? They spend too much time thinking about how they should do it and not if they should do it. Or whatever.
Classic Jurassic Park situation.
Yeah, whatever the Jeff Goldberg quote was from Jurassic Park.
Well, you think that maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't, but you could, and life found a way anyway.
That wasn't,
I don't know, that's not my best.
That wasn't an invitation for a impersonation, but you took it either way.
Had to be done.
Had to be done. This week we're going to start off and hand over to Scott, because you've got your sections to look at first, so over to you now.
Thank you, Graham. I'm going to start with two sort of reviews. One is Burn After Reading, which is a film I've seen quite a few years ago now, but it's the Coen Brothers black comedy crime film from 2008. Basically, John Malkovich is a recently retired, I'm not sure he was retired, but recently no longer in the CIA analyst, whose memoirs are lost, misplaced, etc. And they are found by two employees of a gym, Francis McDormand and Brad Pitt. And they find themselves in over their heads in a sort of extortion plot.
Classic Coen Brothers way.
yeah, it's very classic Coen Brothers. To be honest, it doesn't hold up Is that Simon? Sorry.
I was just going to say, just a couple of doofuses waiting over their heads.
I must say, Brad Pitt is an excellent doofus. He's really good in this film. And it's, yeah, it's very Coen-esque. It isn't as good as I found it the first time, I don't think. I don't think it's one of their top-tier villains. But the performances are great. George Clooney is fantastic. I think he's always great in the Coen Brothers films, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou in particular. Frances McDormand, obviously, she's a great actress and she's great in this as well. Even if it's not one of her most notable roles, it is a good one nonetheless. If you want to look at political comedy, Armando Iannucci is where it's at ultimately. the thick of it's absolutely superb.
Death of Stalin, amazing.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the loop as well.
He's an exemplary practitioner of this. So if you want something to watch political comedy-wise, the thick of it is... Obviously, it's a series, but that is where it's at. Also, another one I've watched, haven't seen before.
What format, what service was...
Apologies, I keep forgetting to highlight that. That is on Netflix. It's something that's on Netflix and Amazon at the same time sometimes, so I'm not sure if it's on Amazon.
A cheap film that everybody's got the rights to.
Yeah, absolutely. I know 100% it's on Netflix, though.
Cool.
The other film I've got this week is The Man with the Golden Arm, which is by Otto Preminger, who also did Laura, Anatomy of a Murder, things like that. This is a 1955 film starring Frank Sinatra as a heroin addict. Well, it's not explicitly stated that he's a heroin addict, but by his presenter, it's either that or morphine and heroin. Heroin is what people think
an opioid of some form.
An opioid, yes. Yeah. That's an easy way to put it. But he's a heroin addict who has just been released from... I'm not sure if it's prison, but it's some sort of rehabilitation facility, which is presumably run by the prison service, by the sounds of it. Obviously, the approaches to mental health and addiction, etc., weren't what they are today, should I say, in the 50s. But in this, Frank Sinatra, of course, an iconic singer, is trying to become a drummer in a jazz band. So he's trying to go clean. He's dealt in, I think it's poker, so he's dealt in poker games for a local criminal, and this criminal is trying to get Frank Sinatra's character to go back into this lifestyle that brought him into contact with heroin and made him an addict. There's also his wife, who is in a wheelchair, having been injured in a car accident, which was caused by Frank Sinatra's character being inebriated. Is it inebriated when there's drugs? I don't know. Anyway, he was high when this happened, and ultimately he's caused injuries in his wife. So I think Anatomy of a Murder is Otto Preminger's best film that I've seen thus far. He did have a lot of films, but this one is it's a bit like The Lost Weekend in a way, sort of the heroin equivalent of that. It's not as good as that, to be honest, but I think Frank Sinatra delivers a very affecting performance. He's no doubt the best thing about this film. It does a really good job of portraying what an addict would be going through, the internal struggles, the physical struggles, etc. But it's certainly a film that I'd recommend. This is on Amazon Prime, along with quite a few other older films, which I have been impressed by, as I said before. I think Amazon Prime are doing a good job with older film representation, which Netflix seem to be trying to do now, but don't do as much, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned those old Scandinavian films that do seem to be appearing on Netflix of late, but hopefully there'll be more to come. Now, I'm just going to talk about a few things that are coming soon to Netflix. These ones are all coming in the next week or two. We've got Army of the Dead, that remake that appears to increase in length every time there's an announcement.
Is it a remake? Or is it just like...
It's not a remake.
It's like a sequel to Dawn of the Dead, kind of.
Is it?
Dead 3 is Army. No, that's Army of Darkness, anyway.
so there's one called Army of the Dead already?
No, well, I don't know.
Okay.
Basically, I think it just looks like Dead Rising, like an adaptation of Dead Rising.
Yeah. It's one of those things that's sort of the offspring of Dawn of the Dead, really.
Yeah, of course.
Or Night of the Living Dead. That's the original. What am I saying? That comes out on the 21st of May, which is a week, which is on Friday,
it's a week,
I believe.
Yesterday. Well, we're recording this on Saturday the 15th, so in just under a week's time. So yes. I think by next episode, I think we should all try to get it watched and
That'll be our next group watch.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. We've also got, interestingly, Spider-Man Far From Home. Obviously, you'd think that might be going on Disney Plus, but obviously, Spider-Man is not owned by Disney. Mm-hmm. So he's owned by Sony, is that? That's right, isn't it?
Have you heard of the deal, though, that's gone on in the past like week, where both Marvel, Sony and Netflix have been doing loads of deals where Netflix, because Marvel don't have the full rights to the Spider-Man universe, Sony have done a deal with Netflix that after the Spider-Man, Venom, all the sort of wider Spider-Man universe, the Sony properties get a cinema release, they'll go to Netflix first, and then they'll go to Disney after that, so that all the Spider-Man, all the Marvel stuff will be all under Disney ultimately, but it's going to be with Netflix first for what's being developed with Sony.
Madness. But it's all, caring and all
it's
that,
all because but, Sony haven't got their own streaming service yet, so it's only a matter of time. As soon as Sony set one up for themselves, it'll be a case of, right, we'll have them to ourselves.
That's coming out on the 25th of May, so... But we can halfway on that one. Now, I haven't seen this, but Highlander is coming on the 16th.
Which will be
by the time this comes out, will probably already be on Netflix. So I haven't seen it myself, but your reaction looks infused, Simon.
Mate, I love Christopher Lambert so much. You know what? Through my celebrity connections and all that with Werner Herzog and Matthew McConaughey and that, I'm sure I could get Christopher Lambert on the podcast.
I'm sure you could, Simon.
Let's do that. Let's do that next episode.
Let's try.
Look forward to it with great anticipation. Now, over on Amazon Prime Video, we've got some interesting things that have recently been added. One is The Social Network, David Fincher's sort of biopic of Mark Zuckerberg, Jesse Eisenberg being brilliant here. I do love this film. I think it's fantastic. I think it betrays what we think Mark Zuckerberg is like very well. Which probably is what he's like.
Probably informs quite a lot of what we think about him as well. It probably has, literally assassinated his character. I mean, I know there's the whole, legal thing going on that's, been raging in the background of the entirety of Facebook's history, but the film really is a damning portrait of the guy.
If you're going to have your character assassinated, it may as well be a masterpiece.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
We've also got the brilliant... It's a Hard Day's Night. It's a Hard Day's Night, of course. the brilliant
it's being a hard
Beatles
day's
film.
Night.
This is an exceptional comedy starring the Fab Four. I believe we saw it in the cinema, Simon. Did we?
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Tyneside? Yeah.
I haven't seen it since, but I'll definitely be watching it now that I'm aware it's on Amazon. It is an absolutely fantastic film. They're all very naturally funny actors in this. Obviously, we're well aware of lots of funny quotes involving the Beatles, but Hard Day's Night is just a fantastic comedy film, regardless of who's in it, really. It's just a great comedy.
I do remember it being very funny.
Drop in, one of the funniest quotes from the Beatles is when John Lennon was asked about Ringo. He said that he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles.
Yeah.
That's mean.
He never missed a beat.
I assume he was referring to himself.
No, he was basically just slagging off Ringo, saying that any of them could have played the drums better than Ringo.
My final pick here is Land of the Dead, because I thought, I've talked about an Of the Dead film, so let's bring another one in. That is one by George C. Romero, which I haven't myself
seen. George A. Romero.
George A. Romero, sorry. I've written a C, I don't know why.
Was this his cousin George C. Romero?
That's George C. Scott. Scott.
Yeah, that's probably what I've done there. obviously, they're very similar in the sorts of films that they're involved in. I need to watch Dawn of the Dead first before I watch any later
You haven't seen
ones.
Dawn of the Dead?
I haven't, no, yeah. I know. That's a shame, really, isn't it?
Shocking.
Top of the list of shame.
I'm sorry to let you down, I really am.
You can borrow the salubrious, is that the right word? The beautiful, let's say, second sight box
second
set from my good self.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or you could buy the standard edition and then let me see what the packaging's like and see if it's worthwhile me buying that standard edition on top of the special edition.
It isn't, but come on.
Oh, but the packaging looks nice. While we're speaking about George A. Romero as well, I know that you've now no longer kept on with your subscription for Shudder, But have you guys seen that Shudder off showing the amusement park? George Romero's long lost film. Yeah, so I'll be interested. I think I might have to sign up for a free subscription just to get that watched. It's meant to be.
Yeah,
amazing.
I think I'll have to sign back up for that one. They've also got like In Search of Darkness Part 2 on there at the minute, so I might just sign back up for a month and then, you know, catch up and whatnot.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Well, it's you get a 7-day free trial. But they often do like month-long ones as like a promotional thing. But I'll see about a 7-day free trial and get that watched.
Cool.
Finally for me, this is my last comment here, but thanks to Simon for pointing out that two of Satyajit Ray's Apu trilogy are now on Amazon Prime. I have mentioned Satyajit Ray before with the
chess players?
The chess players, yes, sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, I've mentioned him before. That's another one that's on here. That's on Amazon. So we've got Pather Panchali and Aparajito, but unfortunately there's no The World of Apu as of yet. So I'll certainly be checking out those two. And fingers crossed, World of Apu comes on there in due course. You would think so if the other two in the trilogy are, but let's see.
It would be a shame if they didn't, I think.
Yeah, they'll be letting people down, but yeah, we'll see.
So it's your turn, Scott, to actually link in nicely to our next feature.
Oh yes, of course.
But thanks for that link to that link, Graham.
I was hoping for a more seamless link there, but I just forgot. Nomadland, which is on Disney Plus. We've all watched it in the last couple of weeks. We'd all set ourselves that aim. And if I start with this, I was very, very impressed. I thought it's commentary on sort of the constraints of the 9-to-5, the grind, whatever you want to call it. Just sort of work and be tired when you finish, go home, sleep, get up, go to work, have 2 days off. It's sort of a commentary on that, and it's just about the freedom of these nomads who choose to live in RVs, caravans, things like that, and they move around America, getting jobs as they go around to get by, but ultimately just living in the environment, sort of camping out in the desert. Obviously not not Death Valley or nothing like that, but just moving around America. I mean, it sounds idyllic, really, and it's presented as such, but no doubt that would be at times challenging existence, being on the road like
especially
that.
Especially when your toilet facilities are so limited, as is illustrated consistently throughout the film.
Well, what do you mean? You had the choice between a 3-litre, 5-litre, and 8-litre bucket?
Yeah, it depends on how big your payload is going to be.
Careful of what you eat.
Yeah, there's this bit where... Frances McDormand's having a conversation with this other nomad. Basically, lots of them have gathered in this place in what looks like the desert. They've all sort of been camping there for some sort of conference, really, for nomads. But there's just Frances McDormand and this other nomad. They're having this conversation, and it's very, very moving because this woman, she has a serious health problem, and just in their conversation, it's like contemplating life and the sort of meaning of it. It's just there's a very moving and poignant conversation there between them, and that was the moment in the film that really grabbed my attention. I thought it was really masterful. Just some great acting there and some great script work in that moment. It's well scripted nonetheless, but I just thought that was the scene that I'd pick out as being particularly special. Yeah.
The thing is about Chloe Zhao's movies is, though, like, they are scripted, but also at the same time, a lot of the people who she casts in them are non-professional actors, and also a lot of people draw from their own life experience. So, for example, in The Rider, the central conflict of the film is about this guy called Brady, who is a buck and bronco rider, and he falls off his horse in the middle of a show, and the horse stamps on his head, and he gets permanent brain damage from it, right? That is an actual thing that happened to the lead actor, and the film is kind of about his life. So, I mean, I'm about to talk about her previous film before that as well, a bit later on, which is very similar, and, you know, people are still drawn from their life experiences in there as well. So I think that's the very good thing that she consistently brings to her movies. I think this one for me, though, was the weakest out of the three, because I felt it kind of got a little bit hijacked by being a Frances McDormand vehicle. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing, because she's great and I love her in pretty much everything. I just think one kind of detracted from the other for me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was those moments where she was like interacting with people and, you know, like people were pouring their heart out to her and all that. But I think like overall the film lacks a bit of drama because, you know, it's like a construct of a drama. Oh, sorry, my cat's sneezing there. I wonder if that picked up on the mic. Yeah, well, he's just, oh, are you okay, Rocket? Yeah, he's fine. Yeah, anyway, what was I saying before? I was rudely interrupted. basically, I think there's a bit of a battle between authenticity and Oscar bait in this one, but still pretty strong. I think it deserved to win Best Picture, and I'm glad that it did, so fair play.
Yeah, I think in comparison with the competition out there, it was a worthy Best Picture winner. I don't think it's going to be one that I'll quickly revisit. I know that Frances McDormand's speech at the Oscars was go and see it in the big screen and support cinema, because I do think the cinematography was wonderful, but I do think you lose a little bit when watching it at home. The bits that I really admired about it were the fact of the use of non-professional actors and genuine real people, and then you could feel there was like a warmth between the professional actor and Frances McDormand and the genuine people who'd experienced that life. But the thing I really liked about it was just the overall sort of mood and atmosphere. It's a film that could have quite easily, if you weren't really focusing on it and you lost, you can lose your attention quite easily, because nothing much happens on it. And I think with lockdown, so many people have been watching things at home where you've got the distraction of your phone right by you, social media. But if you do sit and focus on the film, I think it's got a lot to say. It's got a lot of heart. And I think it's like more of a mood piece. You just have this overall feeling that kind of comes in waves. I think the score does a great job of putting across the sort of feeling and emotion of the character. Frances McDormand, she's in it like 90-odd% of the time. There's not many scenes without her being front and center. But when the camera pulls away and shows some of the scenery, there's been a little bit of story development where you can see something that's going on with Frances McDormand's character. I think the score really helps build emotion. So although it's not as impactful as other films and it doesn't really hammer the message home, it just got this really subtle sort of bit of mood and atmosphere to it, which I thought was really good, but could quite easily be missed if you're not paying proper attention to it.
Yeah. I think I might have liked it a little bit less because I did watch it at home, I must admit. But the thing is, it's actually showing in the cinemas from this Monday.
Yeah.
So it is getting a UK-wide release as well.
But being on Disney Plus, it's a great opportunity for people to see it who might otherwise not. But it's that play to focus on it, see it as if you were seeing it at the cinema without any distractions to really appreciate it. But on that note, I'm going to now hand over to yourself, Simon. You've got your section to now cover.
Well, yeah, so I'm actually going to start with, like I said, Chloe Zhao's done 3 movies so far. Her first movie is currently on Mubi. So this is called Songs My Brother Taught Me, and if you are interested in Chloe Zhao's naturalistic style, then I think that this is a better example than Nomadland. Also, like her second movie, The Rider, it takes place in the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. But instead of looking at the world of buck and bronco riders, it looks at the complicated relationship between a young girl and her older brother who's just about to set up a new life in Los Angeles after graduating. The main drama arises from the brother's involvement in a local bootlegging racket who illegally distribute alcohol around the reservation. And this gives the story a lot of fuel to explore the complicated nature of the modern plight of the Native American people. There's talk in the film about Crazy Horse, so the famous Native American leader in the 19th century, and his prophecy that the 7th generation of his people in the future would be the ones to rise again. And as luck would have it, that's the era that the story takes place in. So in some respects, it's quite optimistic about the future of Native American people against this new cultural landscape. And that, I think, is a lot for the film to take on in a way. But it is so well performed by the people that the film's actually talking about that, you know, obviously it completely earns the the epic scope in a very short runtime. It's quite moving. I'd wholeheartedly recommend it as a double bill with The Rider, which is available to rent through Mubi or BFI Player or Amazon. So you have a variety of options there to finish off Zhao's work so far. But like I said, Songs My Brother Taught Me is available to watch on Mubi with a subscription. Plus points as well for a fantastic exploding car. Probably one of the best I've ever seen. It really did take me aback. I'm also going to look at an earlier film of another director we're featuring on the podcast a little bit later. And this is in the form of Madeline's Madeline, which is still on Mubi after a very long tenure on the service. It's the third feature by Josephine Decker, who is featured in this week's film club with Shirley. So if you quite liked Shirley's manic but quite intimate approach at looking at artistic obsession, then you'll probably find a lot to like here. It's about a young actress who delves into the world of artsy New York theatre and lands in the deep end, and it's not very long before she ends up going completely method and tips over into a little bit of psychosis. I watched it a while back. I'm kind of struggling to remember the specifics of what actually happens in it, but I just thought I'd like to highlight it because Josephine Decker has a very distinctive cinematic voice, and I think Shirley and Madeline's Madeline are quite close cousins in a lot of ways. If you're looking for something even more taxing than Madeline's Madeline, which, you know, approach of caution, I guess, then look no further than Labyrinth of Cinema, which recently came to Mubi after finishing its online festival circuit last month. It's the final film by Nobuhiko Obayashi, who I've talked about in a bit in previous episodes, particularly about his psychedelic cult horror mayhem masterpiece, House, or Houseu. Crunch. Sorry, my cat woke up at that. Yeah, my cat's having a featured appearance on tonight's episode, isn't he? I also talked about his penultimate film, Hanagatami, a good few episodes ago, and this one is more in line with Hanagatami in that it's a very long, very hyperactive trip through a green screen netherworld where narrative coherency and continuity are very foreign concepts indeed. This one is about the fabric of cinema itself, where three very different young men get sucked into a movie during a storm outside, and from there it just careers off into a time-traveling war movie and a very, very strange, very questionable series of romances. I'm unsure of whether I liked it or not. I caught it through a festival recently and I had to sort of squeeze its entire three-hour runtime into an afternoon where I just wasn't in the mood for it. So don't really listen to my opinion. I just really wanted to say that it's on Mubi for you to discover in your own time. Over on Arrow Player this week, I was very pleasantly surprised to find a wealth of work by Jim Cummings. I believe Scott watched Thunder Road on Netflix last year at some point.
Certainly did.
Yeah, and if you remember what was said about this up-and-coming director's work, you'll remember that he specialises in long, awkward, technically very impressive takes. The Minutes collection of short films is an example of that. They're all one-take shorts, all about people having very bad days in a sort of cringe comedy format. I've seen 3 out of the 6 so far. I'd recommend Parent Teacher the most, which is about a high school teacher who finally blows his top with the demanding parents of his students at one particularly miserable parents' evening. But I'd say that Corey Comes to Christmas and The Robbery are also very well performed. Cummings is a very good short filmmaker from the evidence I've seen so far, and the amount that he packs into these real-time sequences is a lot of fun and quite impressive. Some more shorts that are worth a look on Arrow are the early works of David Cronenberg. Arrow do have a Blu-ray of these kicking around too, so the only one that they don't have on Arrow Player is Stereo, but I don't actually think that that's any great loss because I think you can pretty much get everything that that featurette offers you from his next film, which was Crimes of the Future, which marks the beginning of Cronenberg's obsession with cosmetics and body horror. It's about an institute called the House of Skin, where a lanky, creepy dermatologist called Adrian Tripod, or as he would say it, Adrian Tripod, wanders around his complex, engaging with a series of strange characters with venereal growths and foot fetishes. Isn't that nice?
Lovely. The two go hand in hand.
Well, or foot in foot. It's not a lot of fun, but I think that the germs of Cronenberg's interest in grossness and body horror are right here. And I think it is worth saying that Cronenberg's next film, coming out next year, which will be his first in nearly a decade, is also called Crimes of the Future. And by the sounds of it, I think it takes place in the same world. So this 1970 featurette might well be a prequel to that. But I will keep you posted on that front. Let's see what happens. Over on BFI Player, I have a really trashy, almost genius movie that I stumbled upon last week. It's called The Frightened Woman over here in the UK, but it's listed in many other territories as The Laughing Woman. And personally, I think the UK title is better because it's much more ironic. It's about a journalist who gets kidnapped by her scumbag editor boss and trapped inside his garish swinging 60s mod trap house and subjected to a lot of sexual humiliation and threat. However, it's not long before she begins to turn the tables on him and gets inside his head. That's where the real fun begins. I'm not even joking. This film is an absolute riot. It's an Italian production with English dialogue, which is dubbed once again. So goodness knows what that would look like with a deep fake over it. Oh, yeah. And at the end of the day, it is essentially just what I wanted to see from Promising Young Woman. It's a whole lot more subversive and entertaining and weirdly wholesome than that one. So please do check it out. It's really funny and it's very stupid. Finally today, most of my Now TV time has been taken up watching Gangs of London, which is an epic 9-episode crime saga co-created and co-directed by Gareth Evans, who we know from the Raid movies. It kicks off with the death of a property magnate and criminal godfather, Finn Wallace, who is played mostly in flashback by Colm Meaney. And the ensuing drama is about the power vacuum that's left in his absence. Like Game of Thrones, there are multiple different factions from different parts of the world that want a piece of the pie, and each one has very specific grudges against the other. There's an Albanian gang, there's a Turkish gang, drug dealers from Pakistan, a group of Welsh travellers, Danish mercenaries, you name it, they're probably in there somewhere. And it all comes together in, you know, this very diverse and interesting collection of characters. The main selling point is obviously the action, and although there's a bit of a disconnect from what we know about British crime dramas versus the level of gun-happy carnage that, you know, Evans obviously brought to the Raid films, in the first 6 episodes, there is an absolutely relentless, sadistic collection of set pieces that are so unbelievably gratuitous that by the time that the last 3 episodes roll around, there's almost no budget left to do anything than just cut corners and have a lot of angry conversations in offices and kitchens and whatnot. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but you can really tell where the money went on this one. It's been commissioned for a 2nd season, though. Evans is not directly involved in this one, well, or at least on a directorial level, I don't think. But I imagine he'll have some stake in where the story goes from here. If you're looking to start off with this before it becomes the next big thing, be prepared for some really tinier dialogue. But at the same time, I'm not really going to criticize it because I did find it very watchable. I actually watched the whole thing in less than 2 days, which is unheard of for me because I'm still stuck in the middle of watching the last season of 24 that aired about a decade ago. So I'm going to give credit where credit's due here. So that's pretty much it from me. However, I did also say that we were going to talk about our film club this week in the form of Shirley, which is Josephine Decker's new movie about Shirley Jackson. It is not a traditional biopic in the sense that most biopics are. It's kind of more like a fictional snapshot of what might have happened in inspiring the writing of her novel Hangs a Man, which is her first masterpiece, so I'm told. I was going to get a trial on Audible to try and listen to it, but the reader was so awful that I thought, you know, I'm just not going to have the text ruined for me. So I'm going to read it one day because it does seem quite fascinating. We asked you at home to watch it as well and come in with your thoughts. The first batch of comments that we got were actually people just saying that they hadn't seen it, so which was quite funny. But I'm going to read out the comments because, you know, you did put a lot of effort into the comedy of them. So Daniel said, temptation to make some kind of "she can't be serious" joke. It's a airplane reference.
Very good.
Laura said, I saw the trailer for this today. She reminded me of Cameron Diaz in Being John Malkovich. And the tone of it reminded me of, I've forgotten the title of the film. The one with Jesse Buckley and Meth Damon. And it's basically a dream, which was, of course, I'm thinking of ending things. She says, anyway, I haven't heard of Shirley Jackson. didn't realise she was a real person, and I thought it was going to be a bit wishy-washy avant-garde with a non-definitive ending, but you've convinced me to give it a go. Also, if you don't like swearing, cover your ears for a few minutes. I'll come after you if it's shite, mind. We did have another swear from John Ashby on Twitter, who, the four-word review here, he said, utter indulgent dog shit. So he had seen the movie and he didn't like it. Peter said he did like it. This is a 4-star review here. He said, a very disturbing but absorbing horror drama with inventive direction and an incredible performance from Elizabeth Moss. Thank you, Peter. Callum sent us a full-on email, so thank you very much, Callum. He says, I felt the film struggled to find its footing in the first 15 minutes, but hooked me in as we spent more time with Shirley's character, who anchored the film and was able to drag together the loose, insubstantial plot threads into something tangible that was going somewhere and thus pulled me along for the ride. Though all the cast have their moments, it is Elizabeth Moss's enthralling performance that turned a film that could have been too artsy and drab into something you can't tear your eyes away from. Despite relatively little happening for an almost 2-hour runtime, the use of sex and sexual tension to display the shifting balances of power among the characters, along with a constant uncertainty about who to root for, kept the film riveting, and it just about managed to carry it across its themes and commentary on womanhood without being heavy-handed. I wouldn't have complained if 5 minutes had been cut from either side of Shirley, but I was by no means worn out by the time the credits rolled. Lovely stuff, Callum. And also, I was chatting to a pal last night who is coincidentally Shirley Jackson's biggest fan of the world, so he has a review of us talking about it. All right, guys, I'm sat here with a good friend of mine, a friend of the podcast, and also the biggest Shirley Jackson super fan that I know. She's been on the show before. It's Lucy Rose, director of She Lives Alone. How are you doing, Lucy?
Hi, I'm so good. How are you?
I'm fine.
Thank you so much for inviting me to come and profess my love for the woman I would die for.
Well, here is your podium on which to do so. So obviously, I think you know a lot more about Shirley than I do, at least in terms of what actually happened in her life as opposed to the events that are shown in the film. What are some of the differences and why do they work or why don't they work?
This is a tough question. So I've read her biography many times, Rather Haunted Life, which is fantastic. And I've also read the novel Shirley, which the film is based off of. Yeah, it's interesting. I think I would just look at the film as a work of fiction and a homage to Shirley, because that's really what it is. We've had a couple of conversations about this film, and I'm kind of just going to echo what I said in those conversations, which is it is a portrait of who we'd like to think she is through knowing her via her writing and like the impression we get from somebody from reading their words, which is, you know, she's kind of disturbing and there's something uncanny about it and unhinged and odd and thrilling and chaotic, all of which I think definitely come across in the film. I've said this before and I say it to pretty much everybody I speak to about this film, which is I think that Shirley would love this film, even though that sometimes the family aren't painted in the most Mary Sue light. They're definitely like...
quite the opposite of a Mary
Sue.
Yeah,
they're definitely really complex depictions of who they were. You know, not just showing the glossy, nice bits of their marriage and their careers and their life, but also the sort of messy things and some of the things that aren't true. But, you know, we let it slide. I think that she would have really liked this film if she'd have seen it. And I think that she would have had a little bit of a cackle about it. And she's got that dark humor where, like, I feel like she's writing like something really morbid and dark, but she's just laughing as she's writing it because she's just kind of like That's just who she
is. I mean, one of her first lines in the film is literally, "I'm a witch, don't you know?" So
yeah, that's sure, well, that's in real life. Everyone thought she was a witch. That's like something people actually thought she was a witch, which I find hilarious. And she probably knew that and like properly leaned into it.
Capitalized on that, yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah. She's just fantastic. I think it was Neil Gaiman that said she doesn't write with a pen; she writes with a broomstick, which I think is just such a brilliant way to describe her and her writing, because she just writes the most. I remember the first time I read The Haunting of Hill House and it changed me as a person. Like, I can't even describe. It was like a
lightning bolt.
It was. It really was. I saw womanhood in a completely new way, which I'd already known because I'd experienced it, but somebody just said it. And I was just like, oh my goodness. Like the way that, I mean, that first line in Haunting of Hill House, I think so many people can relate to, which is no organism continue to exist long, sanely under the conditions of absolute reality. Because if we acknowledged how fucked up the world was, we couldn't exist. Like, we just couldn't. So we just have to muddle through. And like, that's kind of, I think that's the thesis for a lot of her work, is that like, the world is dark and scary and unhinged and horrible, but you've just got to find a way to get through it, even if that means becoming part of that madness, which again, I think the film touches on quite well. But yeah, I think I said this before as well, like the perspective is really interesting. We were chatting about this. The perspective's really interesting because it's from the perspective of Rose, but you go so far in
character who is not real but is, in a way.
Yeah.
She's so like kind of us looking at her.
Exactly.
Perceiving what we imagine her to be.
This is exactly it. Like, this is what we're saying. Like, it's that and I think I mentioned like that first shot we see of Shirley is like Rose trying to see Shirley through like a crowd of people, and Shirley sat in the chair, and that's us, the people who have loved her work and longed to have seen her face and hear her talk about writing, through this crowd trying to catch glimpses of her. At least that's me. I do have a shrine for her in my house where I have like lots of pictures of her novels and just pictures of her and like, you know, maybe a candle or two, like. But I know, I genuinely think, to summarize my thoughts on this film, it is an extremely fictional but chillingly horrid and disturbed and weird portrait of her, but a portrait that she would absolutely love. That's my opinion. I can see why her family might not necessarily like it, because there are some rather unflattering scenes, story beats in there that don't necessarily paint them out to be the best. But I do think that, you know, I do think she'd watch this and have a bit of a giggle under her breath.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Lucy. And thank you once again, Lucy. I mean, we were just saying just after we finished listening to that, that wasn't on the recording, we don't know how to follow that depth of analysis, but you know what? We're going to certainly try. What did you guys think? Well, what did you give it out of 10? What did you give it?
I gave it a 6, which is sort of my way of saying it's better than average, but I didn't really feel anything for it, which is basically,
It's technically impressive.
I thought Elizabeth Moss was great. I mean, she always is. I'm a big fan of Mad Men, as you know, so I always appreciate her performances, which are always good. I think really it's, aside from that, it's not something I really, I hate using this term, but it's not something I vibed with, really.
Right.
I just think, I don't know, I just found it very, it was very odd, really.
It kind of gets under your skin in a weird way, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It did.
But it also keeps you at a distance of to what to think. And also, you know, there's barely a likable character to latch onto. Yeah. I think the most sympathetic character in a way is kind of Logan Lerman, who is the husband of Rose, who's the effectively like the protagonist of the movie. But he's just so pathetic and easily guided, you know? So I think if there's a proper focal point for the film to latch onto, it's it's a difficult thing to kind of root for anybody at the end of the day. But I think in terms of putting you in the mindset of what Shirley Jackson's work gives you, or at least from what I've experienced of it so far, which is literally from watching the first 6 episodes of the Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. it's more of a feeling than like a perfect snapshot of her life, I think.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
I got that from watching it, that it's very much, it's not a biography. It's a fictionalized story of a what if, to try to get the mood and the feeling of the writer in a sort of snapshot of her life. Without knowing much about Shirley Jackson, other than I knew that she was the writer of The Haunting of Hill House. So I did get the feeling of like not knowing much about her writing, but you could definitely tell that there were elements of the film where they were putting across the atmosphere and some of the themes within her writing. You could tell that the film was putting that into it. It wasn't just about this is a snapshot of one story, this is about the writer as a whole. So you got the feeling of how her character is as a reflection of her writing. It had two bits to it that really rubbed against me straight away when there were bohemian literary intellectuals.
That's my one complaint with the movie, really. Yeah. It's like all of the laughing lecture theatres at like Michael Stuhlbarg's character going, "That was a record. Isn't it funny?" And then all the girls in the class like, like kind of unironically.
they've
probably got like the Indiana Jones writing on top of their eyelids. Yeah. That's like, "I love you."
That bit alone was like enough to kind of like almost make me lose my attention for it. But I stuck with it. The other bit that I didn't really enjoy was the fact that why do all writers and films get made out to be these otherworldly creatures who've got such deep things going on that they can't be explained in black and white? And it's just like, yeah, fair enough.
Sure. You're evidently not a writer, Graham.
I'm sorry, but I just see the world in black and white. but those points to be said, I've got to say that, I mean, I'm probably with you on this, Scott. I think the film, it's an accomplishment of technically of being made. I thought it looked very good. It conveyed atmosphere and mood really well. Some of the cinematography and some of the shots and things like that were really good. But I just didn't feel as if I knew enough around the characters to be invested in it. I think if you're a Shirley Jackson fan, then yes, it's definitely one to seek out. For your casual viewer, I'm not too sure it would keep people glued to watching it.
It's a weird film to have on Netflix in that respect, I think.
Yeah, I mean, because especially the fact that Netflix wasn't involved in the production or anything, for it to be so soon to be on Netflix as well, because it was only made in 2020. Martin Scorsese exec produced it, I noticed.
Yeah. I mean, he does like quite a lot of things. I mean, he executive produced Uncut Gems and Free Fire, stuff like that. So he knows where to put his money into diverse and interesting projects, really. So.
Yeah. I do think it was an interesting film. I'm glad to have seen it. Now, when I go on to see more of the like Shirley Jackson's works, I'll have a bit more of a kind of taster for what to expect. Yeah. Whereas I think if you know Shirley Jackson first to then come to this, this probably solidifies how you already feel about her work. So I'm coming at it from that angle. I mean, bits that I particularly liked was I had a feeling of like latter-day Terrence Malick films, where there was lots of like lingering shots of like these beautiful bits of scenery or in the woodlands or of the sky. Little bits of that, because the rest of it, where it was in the household, I don't know whereabouts it's based. It looked kind of like almost sort of Mississippi-esque, but I believe...
I think it's Denver?
Denver, because apparently I'm sure I read Colorado somewhere? Yeah, I'm sure that I read that the actual, in real life, they moved to Canada. But it feels like a kind of quite claustrophobic, quite sort of humid kind of place, and a lot of the shots within the house are very dark and grainy. Overall, I'd agree with sort of 6 out of 10, but not to be negative on it, I do think it had something to it, but I just probably wasn't the right audience.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's an 8 out of 10 for me, mainly because I think... It reminded me of Twin Peaks in a few ways. And I'm going to say this
reminds you of Twin Peaks.
But in an interesting way, not just like a sort of superficial, like, oh, you know, there was like some jazzy, you know, like finger snapping and then they were drinking coffee at one point. No, it's more like Shirley Jackson's interest in this girl who went missing. You know what I mean? It's like how interested David Lynch is in the fact that, you know, Laura Palmer died and all that sort of thing. It's that interrogation of the evil of the world, and particularly that of misogynistic evil. And I think, okay, I'm not really qualified to talk about how Shirley did it in Hangs a Man or how Josephine Decker's really done it in Shirley, but I don't know. I think it's an interesting contribution to the conversation about portraying female trauma and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, 8 out of 10 for me. The only things that really annoyed me were like all of the scenes of people laughing at lecturers. And I've been in so many lectures where so many jokes from lecturers have fallen completely flat on their face. So
yeah.
I'm not buying that, I'm sorry. But yeah, everything else, yeah, thumbs up from me.
Very good. Right, well, and thank you once again to everyone who's contributed to that. So we will look to do another film club in the near future. So keep an eye out. We will mention, because have you had two picks now, Simon, or has it been Scott and you? I can't remember who.
Scott and me, and now it's you next time.
Yeah. Oh, you did the Sisters Brothers, Scott. Yeah, cool. So yeah, it's up to me to do the next one. So
be merciful, please.
I'll do something.
I know I wasn't, but.
Yeah, but we've generally picked things that we'll try to keep to Netflix because it's generally the most sort of common streaming service.
Yeah.
And it's something generally that might go under the radar with Netflix, so something a bit sort of out there that you might not necessarily find within the algorithm. So I'll see what I can dig out for a future episode.
Nice.
But over to my section now. So I'm going to cover what's on TV. It's quite a sparse week, to be honest. I know that we record this and we're a bit time sensitive over when release, so you don't need to worry about getting this edited lightning fast, Simon, because I've only got one pick of what's on TV. For
I start work on Monday, so
Well, it's next Saturday, so Saturday the 22nd at 9:30 at night, Channel 4. And we've got Sicario 2, Soldado, or Day of Soldado, depending on however you want to pronounce it.
Got like five titles, ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a long while since I've seen either, the original Sicario, which absolutely loved, by the way. And also I saw Sicario 2 at the movies. I enjoyed it, obviously. It wasn't quite on a par with the first one. But I do think it is worth a watch to continue on the story of their characters, namely Josh Brolin's and
Benicio del Toro.
That's the one. Thank you, my memory for names.
You never disappoint.
I don't know. I'll just click my fingers until you tell me. But after my last episode of Good Little Nuggets of Information, I'll just go through a couple of little tidbits of Sicario 2 for you. Any guesses for what Sicario stands for?
Hitman?
Yes, very good.
Well, didn't I explain this in the last episode when I talked about El Sicario Room 164?
You did, yes.
Or in episode 28, that is.
What about Soldado?
Soldier.
Oh, particularly a Latin American.
I have
soldier,
a B in GCSE Spanish, so yes.
Very good. But a little nugget about the film as well is that the film is dedicated to the composer Johan Johansson, who did the original score for the first film. He died in February 2018. And also, this is set as the second film of a potential trilogy. So I'm yet to hear any news of a third. I don't know. I think the plaudits were all out for the first one. I don't think this one got quite the critical response because there's an element of the story which is so far-fetched.
Are we on about I've lost the cheek thing?
Yes.
Yeah. And that is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, if you guys, listeners out there, have seen it, you'll know what we're talking about, and you've probably rolled your eyes the same as we all did. If you haven't seen it yet, please check it out. Try to suspend disbelief and go with it. But yeah, I think the first film, and certainly what the second one does up to the cheek bit, you kind of go with it. But you, at the same time, you just think, no way. No
way. Absolutely not. Because that guy wouldn't have any teeth left. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it lost me, and I was just like, oh, okay, fair enough. So I think as well that it lost the critics from that point, and so whether a third one will happen or not, it remains to be seen. But for how good the first one was, I think the second one does pick up quite well, and it does mm-hmm. continue on, but I think it does lose its way.
I think it might happen, actually, because Taylor Sheridan's got like 2 movies out at the minute, so... Mm-hmm. He's got Without Remorse on Amazon Prime, so that's sort of co-written by him. It's a Tom Clancy yeah. adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's the new Angelina Jolie film. It's like
Those Who Wish Me to Die or something, is it called?
Yeah, Those Who Wish Me Dead, I think.
Those Who Wish Me Dead, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I saw the trailer for that a long while ago, and I just looked at it and I was just like, Angela Jolie kind of action part thriller. And then I was like, oh, Taylor Sheridan wrote it, and... Well, he directs it as well.
Yeah.
And his writing is great, so I was just like, oh, actually, that's piqued my interest a bit now. So
I think he's been on a downward spiral ever since the first Sicario, because Sicario was great, Hell High Water was very good, Wind River, terrible, Sicario 2, even worse. so I'm kind of like, well...
I quite enjoyed Wind River, but he directed that as well.
Yes.
So it's whether it's that whole thing of, what's his name, the writer who did Social Network?
Aaron Sorkin.
Aaron Sorkin, thank you again, my memory. He's great at writing. He directed Molly's Game. Brilliant script. Direction is very much tab A into slot B.
Yeah. Same with Trial Chicago 7. Decent movie, but... Could have been elevated far beyond its
exactly. Its so these tortured otherworldly writers, they should stick within their little box and not go in to become even extra otherworldly directors. As much as they suffer for their art, just stick to what you're good at.
Fair point. Yeah, can't disagree.
So with only one TV choice, there's a couple of bits on streaming to look at. These were films that were actually just on last night and this past week, in fact, over the BBC. So on BBC iPlayer, you've got Long Shot, which stars Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. On the day that we record today, very good impression. On the day that we record today, the 15th of May, it's available for the next 29 days. Now, I'm not the biggest fan necessarily of Seth Rogen films, the kind of slacker, stoner comedies. They get a bit tired, but I think this one treads a different path. Yes, he plays a semi-slacker stoner, but who happens to also be quite a good writer.
Not an otherworldly writer, but just a kind of like unpretentious...
A journalist, yeah.
Yeah.
they're a different kettle of fish altogether. but basically he quits his job out of protest over the fact that a media mogul buys the company that he's working for, and his old high school babysitter, who turns out to be Charlize Theron, who is Secretary of State, is looking for a writer to jazz up her speeches. I won't go too much further into plot there, because I think it's quite a good story. I think there's some great gags to it, great little slapsticky moments, but it does have a bit more heart, it has a bit more story. I think the flexibility of Charlize Theron as well has really been demonstrated. She's done action, she's done comedy, she's done drama. I think she goes from strength to strength. She's got some roles where you do feel as if she's just phoning it in and she's paying the mortgage off, but there's a lot of films where you just see a totally different side to her. This is one that I think it went under the radar a lot. I remember when it was on the Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode film show on 5 Live, and they got on talking about interviewing her, and they talked about Roxette half the time because it's a song that features quite prominently into it, and Simon Mayo went on about how he interviewed them once and they were absolute douchebags. But the film itself, I don't know if anyone who bothered watching it, it just didn't go, it bubbled under the radar. I first saw it when it was on Netflix. I think it might still be on there, but if you've got, well, everyone, you'll have access to iPlayer. So do check it out, because it is a really good comedy, which I do think was quite underappreciated.
One tidbit before you move on from that, who mm-hmm. plays aforementioned media mogul?
Yeah, the first time I saw it, I didn't know. But then after the second time, I was just like, Yeah. Well, we won't spoil it, but...
Yeah. But when you realise, you're like, oh my goodness, that guy.
Yeah. A lot of prosthetics.
What a treasure.
Yeah. Next up is one that I haven't seen, but one that I've had on my list, and thankfully it was on BBC Two last night, so it's on iPlayer for the next 29 days, is Manchester by the Sea. With Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams. I know it got massive critical reviews when that came out. The story of an uncle who has to look after his nephew after the death of his brother, stroke nephew's father. I don't know much about it other than the fact that Casey Affleck was just getting so many plaudits for his acting in it. So, but also it was around the time where there was some sort of story of him, abuse story or some comments he came out with.
Yeah, I think it was a sexual harassment thing on the set of I'm Still Here. Which they did settle out of court, I think.
Film
a bit troubling, but he is fantastic in the movie, I've got to say.
Yeah, so I think the film probably... Well, I know they do say that any PR is good PR, but I do think it probably sort of lost some of the wind in its sails due to that. So, but yeah, from what I hear of the film being so good, I'll be meaning to get that watched. Next one on iPlayer, one which is very much seen every year. It's a Christmas special. 22 days, for the next 22 days, it's available on iPlayer. It's When Harry Met Sally, Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan.
I need to see it.
Yeah, you've not seen it. Unbelievable. Rob Reiner directing, Nora Ephron script. Billy Crystal must have improvised his heart out, but the script as well just seems so tight. Meg Ryan just doing a brilliant performance of just keeping up with Billy Crystal. I think it's perfect. It's got heart, it's got wit, it's got truths. Yeah, you really need to watch it. And as well, it's only 90 minutes, just over 90 minutes long. It packs so much in.
I could do it this week, you know. I could. Yeah,
honestly, get it watched. You'll absolutely love it. You'll thank me for it. But then that's it mainly from me. But the just next little bit to look out for will be... And Scott's already covered it, Army of the Dead, because I think you mentioned it a little while back, Simon, that Zack Snyder and Justice League was the first thing that we kind of covered and talked about in our very first episode.
Yeah.
And we kind of feel as if we've already come full circle with the Snyder cut of Justice League coming out, but it's now Zack Snyder version 2.0 with Army of the Dead shortly coming out on
Netflix. Let's not make a thing of it. No, I mean we can. I'm quite excited for it. It does look like his Suicide Squad, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, at least Suicide Squad wasn't 148 minutes. But guess what? Army of the Dead is. So I know I said it was 139 three or four episodes ago, but turns out it's even longer than that.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll sit through it for you guys out there. If you care to hold off and wait for our reviews, if you trust us or not. But yeah, we'll definitely be getting that watched. But as well, a little bit of news is our next episode that we plan to record will probably be either on or around our 1 year anniversary. So we're going to do a bit of a recap on what we've covered. We'll come up with a few ideas, but also just wanted to thank you listeners out there for your contributions this week and to continue with those contributions. We try as much as we can to put out posts on our social media of things that we don't necessarily get to pick out in the podcast. So films that are on, news stories and things like that. So if you're not following us on our socials, do look out for us on Twitter at @podcasters, Instagram at @invasionofthepodcasters, Facebook, Invasion of the Podcasters. We've got a Gmail account if you ever want to get in touch, podcastersuk@gmail.com. And then also we have a Letterboxd account, which is letterboxd.com/podcasters. But from myself, thank you very much for this episode. So to Scott and Simon, thank you. And for you listeners out there, look forward to doing it again soon.
I look forward to doing it again soon as well. Bye, guys, from Simon.
And goodbye from Scott.
All right, until next time. Bye-bye.